C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung. Am 14. September 2021 hat ein Online-Webinar der internationalen Karl-Polanyi-Gesellschaft stattgefunden. Beyond Deglobalization and Globalization – Policy Spaces for Social Ecological Transformation. In der heutigen Ausgabe von C3 Radio berichten wir darüber. Es begrüßt Sie Jürgen Planck. Miteinander diskutiert haben Miriam Lang, Colleen Schneider und Ian Gaff. Moderiert wurde das Webinar von Ulrich Brandt und Andreas Novi, die beide Artikel veröffentlicht haben, die als Diskussionsgrundlage gedient haben. Novis Artikel trägt den Titel »The Political Trilemma of Contemporary Social Ecological Transformation – Lessons from Karl Polanyi's The Great Transformation«. Gemeinsam mit rund 15 Co-Autorinnen hat Brandt den Artikel »From Planetary to Societal Boundaries – An Argument for Collectively Defined Self-Limitation« verfasst. Damit sind wir beim Hintergrund des Themas jenseits von Deglobalisierung und Globalisierung, Politikräume für sozial-ökologische Transformation. Denn die Frage nach den Grenzen des Wachstums steht erneut an der Tagesordnung. Allerdings hat der Ansatz, von den planetarischen Grenzen auszugehen, den Diskurs zu globalen Umweltfragen tiefgreifend verändert. In jüngster Zeit sind nun auch Überlegungen zu gesellschaftlichen Grenzen hinzugekommen, die kollektive Autonomie und die Politik der Selbstbeschränkung als Schlüsselelemente definieren. Dieses erweiterte Konzept erkennt vielfältige Erfahrungen an, die sowohl Wohlstand als auch die Grenzen desselben integrieren. Damit werden Alternativen eröffnet, die soziale Freiheit fördern, die als das Recht, nicht auf Kosten anderer leben zu müssen, definiert wird. Es entsteht ein utopischer Horizont, der die Suche nach sozial-ökologischen Alternativen zur neoliberalen Globalisierung strukturiert. In diesem utopischen Konzept fehlen jedoch oft konkrete Antworten auf die Herausforderungen, die sich aus gegenläufigen Dynamiken in der Gesellschaft ergeben. Sei es das Mehrheitsdenken, das eine Einschränkung des eigenen Konsumverhaltens ablehnt, oder etwa Gegnerinnen eines guten Lebens für alle, die die Zusammenarbeit und Solidarität zu dessen Erreichung verhindern. Haltungen, die heute zunehmend in verschiedenen Formen reaktionärer Politik präsent sind. Inwiefern kann Karl Polanyis Schlüsselwerk The Great Transformation in Bezug auf die gerade stattfindenden sozioökologischen Transformationen brauchbare Ansätze liefern? Und welche Alternativen gibt es zur imperialen Lebensweise nach Brandt? Andreas Novi schreibt: In The Great Transformation, Polanyi investigated the Industrial Revolution, which despite its name was an evolutionary process with a revolutionary outcome. A slow but profound transformation of modern civilizations, institutions and routinized ways of living and working, from agrarian subsistence to rural exodus, urbanization and factory work. Aktuell stehen ähnliche Transformationen an, ebenfalls in den Bereichen Arbeit, Stichwort Digitalisierung, und Urbanisierung, aber auch in Bezug auf die Umwelt, Stichwort Klimawandel. Miriam Lang ist die Direktorin der Rosa-Luxemburg-Stiftung für die Andenregion und bezieht sich in ihrer Keynote insbesondere auf indigene und bäuerliche Lebensweisen in Lateinamerika.
Which today acquire such an importance because they are accountable for roughly preserving and grooming 80% of still existing biodiversity. So we have an opportunity to learn from their ways of understanding the world, understanding their perspectives on well-being, on needs, understanding their way of framing interdependence with nature and enacting reciprocity, and also the quality of relations as a central feature of quality of life.
Diesem Verstehen stünden zuweilen politische Entscheidungen entgegen, denn der Vergleich zwischen Ländern des Südens und des Nordens etwa in Bezug auf politische Institutionen und eine sozioökologische Transformation sei schwierig, sagt Lang und berichtet über Ecuador und Brasilien.
Ecuador has made headlines in 2008 because it constitutionalized the nature. But then in 2013, the progressive government of Rafael Correa started to exploit oil in one of the most biodiverse hotspots of the world in the Ecuadorian Amazon, the Yasuni National Park. And 1 year later, in 2014, it even subordinated the Ministry of Environment to the Ministry of Non-Renewable Resources. Brazil's President Bolsonaro said before he took office, if I become president, there will not be a centimeter more of indigenous land. There are historical reasons for the contrast between relative stability of institutional policy frameworks in the global north and their consistent instability in the global south. Those reasons root what Aníbal Quijano called the coloniality of power. According to this theory, different purposes and roles were assigned to different world regions. It could be said that since then, Latin America has had the role of providing raw materials toward other parts of the world, where those then were processed and later industrialized.
Abschließend hält Miriam Lang in Bezug auf Institutionen und erkämpfte Rechte im Rahmen der sozioökologischen Transformation fest.
In the global south, in countries like, for example, Ecuador or Brazil, every single victory has to be secured again and again, both at the regulatory level, but also in factual territorial struggles, in a sort of exhausting tugging over power relations. And I think this is a huge difference to countries like Germany or Britain, where certain frameworks simply give solid grounds to certain achievements of struggles. Now, of course, much has been said about that developing countries still lack their institutional capacities to consolidate their democracies, etc. But I think that these problems I just described are not about simply being at a different stage on a linear path to progress and democracy, and that they are not accurately described with this not yet discourse of institutional capacities. The recent successes in Afghanistan might have given us an eloquent lecture about that.
Moderator Ulrich Brandt ergänzt.
There is an interesting tension in the paper that we argue with autonomy and the concept, of course, of autonomy and freedom in a sense which comes from below, which is organized at a societal level. But at the other hand, we might underestimate in the paper a bit the question of rules, the question of concrete settings of achievements, which are then secured. When we think about policy space in the global north, we have these more stabilized institutional settings when we have the rules, for example, to change energy production and consumption or to change the mobility system or to change certain production systems. There is a durability, there is a certain continuity that we can promote with this social ecological transformation.
Abschließend schlägt Miriam Lang eine Brücke zu Karl Polanyi.
In our article about societal boundaries, we speak about the right to not live at the expense of others, which is an idea that I like very much, which is very important in our times. But I think the challenge that the global north faces today is maybe also the challenge not to transform at the expense of others, and to understand that the interdependence that we have to incorporate in our strategies is not only between human societies and nature, but also between societies in the global south and in the global north. And only then we will achieve liberty, not only for the few, but for all, as Karl Polanyi stated, in perspective of global justice.
Ian Gough is visiting professor at London School of Economics, for many years working in Manchester at the Institute for Social Policy. And he's well known for his book that he wrote in 1991 with Len Doyle on A Theory of Human Need. And from social policy, he shifted in the last, I think, 10 years or more to a social ecological transformation. And he has written this very important book, Heat, Greed, and Human Need, Climate Change, Capitalism, and Sustainable Development. And that was a key reason why we invited him.
The Ulrich Brandt et al. Paper starts off with three good questions. How are concerns for planetary developments related to territorialized policy spaces? Second, how devise policy spaces for collectively defined self-limitation? And third, how to situate this within global capitalism? First of all, we require some universal normative frame in order to relate the global and the territorial. Secondly, we need a mechanism for collective self-determination. And thirdly, we need a realist model of the political economy, bringing capitalism back in. One of the interesting things is the appendix to the paper on these reverse alternatives, which was all new to me and very helpful. And I looked through those, and it seemed to me that these alternatives suggest three main themes. First of all, a strong interrelation between individual and collective well-being. You can't separate off the individual. Second, that well-being also comprises all non-human elements. That came through strongly. Other species, nature, geography, weather, the planet. And a third theme was that alternative forms of collective determination are needed beyond Western democracy. The first and the third of those I'm completely in agreement with, but I wanted to spend a minute or two on the second one, the notion that well-being comprises all non-human elements. The idea of non-human needs, which I've come across before, and which accords an intrinsic status for the preservation of nature, irrespective of its contribution to human welfare. That I find problematic. I mean, if you're not giving priority to humans over other organisms, you might indeed give priority to non-human needs over human needs. I still want to argue that human needs provides the only, I think, universal frame there is.
Ian Gough beschreibt in der Folge zentrale menschliche Bedürfnisse.
Participation or affiliation, one, health or bodily integrity, two, and autonomy or practical reason, three.
In Bezug auf self-limitation, merkt Ian Gough an.
And I'm struck by some examples here, climate assemblies, mainly in rich countries, which I think is an early example of territorialized collective self-limitation. It's a fascinating thing, but the climate assemblies in France and in the UK and elsewhere, draw together a random sample of people who, after 6 or 9 months of dialogue with experts as well, come up with a consensus on a series of restrictions on consumption in Western countries. And then you have the research of Julia Steinberger and others in Leeds and in Switzerland, which works out, can we meet this sort of minimal standard of living from an energy perspective on a world scale and not contravene planetary boundaries. And they find that this can be done for a population of 10 billion people, but it would require cuts of up to 95% by the highest energy consumers.
Limitierung wird also jedenfalls nötig sein. Colleen Schneider arbeitet für die Karl Polanyi Gesellschaft und geht in ihrer Keynote insbesondere auf die Rolle der Zentralbanken im Geldsystem ein und bezieht sich auf das Paper von Brandt und Kolleginnen.
The Brandt et al. Paper talks generally through most of it about, in the context of societal boundaries, about what the collective is or what society is. And at the end of the paper comes more concretely to the nation state and, very justifiably problematizes this as a container to work through, but also makes the point that working through it is necessary and working to transform the shape of it is necessary. So what I'd like to do is discuss the policy space of the state through the lens of the monetary system, the space that the state has to use money as a tool, and how that space is shaped by the globalized system of financial capitalism, and money is social power. Money is also a marker of faith between the holder and the monetary sovereign that guarantees its value. It's a social contract. A central authority is able to issue money to pay for goods and services necessary to provision the state and take that money back out of circulation through taxation. Now, coming back to money as a tool of the state, the real limit on government spending is the productive capacity of the domestic economy and the regenerative capacity of the natural environment. So politically constructed limits on public debt constrain the ability of the state to treat its sovereign currency as a public good. So to say, it artificially constrains the space we have to work with for developing societal boundaries, right? It's putting an artificial boundary around that. As Keynes said, we can afford anything we can actually do. And this understanding was clear during World War II, and we can see this again now during COVID. And I think this understanding of fiscal policy space makes budgetary decisions more significant. It makes it clear that how money is spent is a political, not a financial decision.
Im Kapitalismus spielen Zentralbanken eine wichtige Rolle, betont Colleen Schneider.
and propping up the financial system and in sustaining capitalism's systemic growth dependence, especially since the Great Financial Crisis. They act as first responders in economic crises and are arguably the most important economic policymaking agencies right now. At the same time, they're understood as being independent from the elected branch of government, an independence justified by the logic that they abide narrowly by a technocratic mandate. But this independence isn't some optimal arrangement. It's the institutionalized version of a power struggle that has been dominated by the financial sector since the early 80s. So we're now in an arrangement where central banks rely on deep and liquid, which means large and powerful, financial markets to transmit monetary policy. So they need them for their own monetary policy. And in turn, financial markets rely on central banks to maintain an effective price floor on a growing pool of assets. Quantitative easing, for example, is a critical part of this. And it's now quite clear that quantitative easing provides disproportionate financial support to carbon-intensive companies and sectors, and more generally increases wealth inequality. And central bank balance sheets jumped due to these asset purchases to QE during COVID response measures, compensating for politically imposed fiscal restrictions, right? So this is monetary policy having to be more active to compensate for limits on fiscal policy.
Damit US-Staatsanleihen eine sichere Anlagemöglichkeit bleiben, hat die Fed, die amerikanische Zentralbank, begonnen, Anleihen zu kaufen. Mehr als während der Finanzkrise 2008-2009. So Colleen Schneider.
So a million in assets per second and over 80 billion in a day. And maybe this sounds like a good thing, like central banks are exercising the full power and force of the monetary system, but in whose name and to what end? If we're talking about policy space for genuine social ecological transformation, policy needs to have the capacity to drive meaningful change to our systems of production and provisioning, to labor relations, and to class hierarchies. And what's happening now with finance and monetary policy is hugely different than what had been the status quo, but it's done to maintain the existing social hierarchy, to maintain the project of neoliberalism. It's a case of everything must change so that it can stay the same.
Welche Ansätze sieht Colleen Schneider, um das Finanzsystem zu einem Werkzeug für eine sozial-ökologische Transformation zu machen?
As the Brand et al. Paper points out, we must target institutions, power relations and growth logic and not focus on technocratic fixes. In terms of credit regulation, understanding credit as endogenous is emerging out of our social needs. We see that credit allocation is a political act. In terms of debt ceilings, the EU's Stability and Growth Pact is on pause at the moment to give member nations room to deal with the economic impacts of COVID. And there's debate about when this will be reinstated, if this should be reinstated. I would argue that we need a different alternative altogether, and that this politically imposed ceiling is detrimental to attempts of member nations to institute any genuinely transformative policy around the climate crisis.
Colleen Schneider, abschließend.
I wanted to discuss a bit around currency and ecological and social and racial hierarchies and how are these intertwined, but I'll just finish by saying that the great financial crisis, the Eurozone crisis, and now COVID have shown us that political constraints are more elastic than many people had previously imagined. A progressive politics that wants to resist the affinities of conservatism or authoritarianism needs to get really comfortable with the depth of government agency and the choice that implies. Thank you.
Andreas Novi stellt in Bezug auf alternative Geldsysteme diese Frage.
Take El Salvador going to bitcoins. Is it possible to have collectively defined self-limitation in the global south without some type of monetary sovereignty, Colleen?
The global south has some level of effective monetary sovereignty, but much less than the global north. And these proposals that I mentioned before in response to Miriam were intended to increase the level of effective monetary sovereignty for the global south. And I would argue that that needs to happen to be in a space where you can collectively, democratically, politically establish these societal boundaries.
Dazu ergänzt Miriam Lang.
I actually pretty much agree with what Colleen is proposing for a transformation of the international finance system. I think it is urgent to repoliticize debt, not only in terms of debt forgiveness, but also in terms of recognition of historical debts and ecological debts and colonial debts. There have been calculations, for example, how much Britain would owe India in terms of paying back what has been extracted from their and reestablishing just relations. It would help, of course, a lot if we would reframe that in this sense. I was thrilled when I learned that in the context of the COVID crisis, when the German government issues government bonds, it has zero costs. When the Ecuadorian government issues government bonds, they have to pay like 15%. So even in the small corridor of trying to get some liquidity to attend the crisis, there is still an inbuilt injustice. And this is related to how we politicize debt, I think, and how, of course, international finance systems are framed and work. An interesting debate for me is also how we can maybe increase monetary sovereignty by creating different monies for different purposes, as Alf Hornburg states this, who criticizes very much this general purpose money, which is always convertible. And there are lots of places in the world where you have those local currencies, which are more social currencies, which are deliberately used to strengthen local economies and local exchange. So we could maybe think in a direction that allows us to have different currencies at different scales, which have limited purposes and are one inside the other, and only a limited currency for global interactions. And that would be a good protection against some international unequal dynamics.
So Miriam Lang von der Rosa-Luxemburg-Stiftung. Zusammenfassend sagt Moderator Ulrich Brandt.
The debate on sustainability transformation, let's say the mainstream green debate, yeah, listening to the German debate now prior to the elections, is about consumption, about green growth, and the main responsible, the main actor is the consumer, and then of course green investment. But what is really out of sight, out of the debate, is really a mode of production and a mode of living, the really deep structures, how we are forced to live this, how we are forced at the production side and the consumption and the mode of living to reproduce constantly the imperial mode of production and living. And this is what we need to work on, but also we need to speak it out publicly, that the corridor of thinking, the Green Party now in Germany, it's such a narrow corridor of thinking alternatives, given the deep crisis. I would say I take this with me from the debate that we have to rethink it and to link it to the money question, which Colleen put up.
Und Andreas Novi ergänzt abschließend.
I was very happy that we introduced the monetary debate, which, as we agree, is a little bit lacking in the social ecological transformation debate. And it enriches our understanding for universalizing. And here again, I think this universal needs, universal standards, universal basic services, they are ambivalent. I acknowledge that Miriam insists in diversity and the autonomous spaces of indigenous people, but other groups as well. Yeah? But on the same time, we need some notion of universality if we want to live together and achieve strategies for all, because what is for all different from the universal? And in using your language, I think, Ian, it's quite obvious that the diversity and the democratic deliberation enters via the need satisfiers. And the need satisfiers, they are very context specific, yeah, and they are contested and democratically struggled for and very different in urban and rural areas, etc., etc. These two attempts, having common universal standards and understandings and having diverse ways of implementing it, that's part also of this multi-scalar strategy that we should use. And their foundational basic services, they have to be decided in decentralized ways. And I think that's exactly your concept of needs and need satisfiers is a very good complement to our arguments for multi-scalar strategies with different levels having different responsibilities and tasks.
Das war C3 Radio. In unserer heutigen Ausgabe haben wir über ein Online-Webinar der Internationalen Karl-Polanyi-Gesellschaft berichtet, das am 14. September 2001 zum folgenden Thema stattgefunden hat. B beyond deglobalization and globalization, policy spaces for social ecological transformation. Der Artikel von Andreas Novi, The Political Trilemma of Contemporary Social Ecological Transformation, Lessons from Karl Polanyi's The Great Transformation, kann auf der folgenden Website abgerufen werden: www.tnfonline.com. Dort findet man auch den Artikel von Ulrich Brandt und anderen, From Planetary to Societal Boundaries, An Argument for Collectively Defined Self-Limitation. Informationen zur Karl-Polanyi-Gesellschaft gibt es auf www.karlpolanyisociety.com. C3 Radio hören Sie wieder in einem Monat und ständig als Podcast auf c3radio.potspot.de. Informationen zu allen Angeboten im C3-Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung sind auf www.zentrum3.at abrufbar. Ein Veranstaltungshinweis: Am 18. November findet von 9 bis 15 Uhr die folgende Online-Veranstaltung statt: Green Deal, der europäische Beitrag zur Umsetzung der SDGs. Was verspricht er und wie können wir uns an seiner Umsetzung beteiligen? Das ist eine Living Library-Veranstaltung für Schulklassen. Auf Wiederhören sagt Jürgen Planck. C3 Radio aus dem Zentrum für internationale Entwicklung. Mit den Organisationen Baobab, Frauensolidarität, Mattersburger Kreis, ÖFSE und Paulo Freire Zentrum. Weitere Informationen und Podcast auf www.zentrum3.at.